So this is the Living Legacy Project at, mm-hmm. at the Birchfield Pinney Arts Center, and it is June 20th, 2017. And I am here with Elizabeth Licata. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Yeah.
So the questions, sorry, I have them on my phone because the questions I'm going to be asking you today are variations on what I normally ask, because most of the time I'm interviewing visual artists who talk about their work and stuff like that, but I don't want to be presumptuous in assuming that you don't consider yourself an artist. So can you talk a little bit about your experience both working in the arts and also being a writer yourself?
Sure. I don't consider myself an artist.
Okay.
I consider myself a writer and an editor and sometimes a curator. And the main way that I've gotten involved in the arts is through those activities.
Yeah. Can you speak a little bit about where your trajectory, both working in the arts and writing about the arts, started?
Well, I guess I've always been interested. My parents had small collections. I looked at books. And then when I went to this college, Buff State, I was a regular visitor to the Albright Knox. So it was something that I accepted as part of my ongoing life, something that I would always want to do was go to museums or galleries and look at art. So then when I started in journalism, I suppose, at, I guess, the first place, well, I was involved in high school, but I suppose the first place was at the Spectrum at UB, and I was the arts editor there and did some reviewing, book reviews, maybe some gallery, yeah, some interviews. I remember interviewing Tony Comrade. I interviewed a lot of, I went to Hallwalls a lot and wrote. And so then I started writing at some point for the Buffalo News. And then this was when I was sort of on hiatus from my academic career. I'd gotten my BA and I was sort of on hiatus from grad school. And so I started writing for art magazines. I wrote for Art in America, Art News, Art Forum, Art and Antiques. Art and Antiques was a big Birchfield article about, yes.
Yep.
So I just continued all this. And all along for the news and really any kind of publication, because I had time at that point. And then I started working at the Castellani Art Museum, and I got that job because of writing, because I was there to help write interpretive labels and help people negotiate their viewing experience. Because at that time in the early 90s, you did not have any kind of label other than the name of the artist, the medium, the date, who donated it, and so on. You didn't have that stuff. I suppose that there were audio tours then, but museums around here didn't have them. And so we looked at computer interactive stuff. We eventually went on to online stuff. But basically I started writing all these long labels. And so that's how I got that job. And I had that for about 9 years. And it eventually became a curator.
Mm-hmm.
And did a lot of projects. And one of my favorite projects that sort of dealt with that sort of intersection of writing and what we think of as visual art was with Robert Creeley, who his poetry, he had worked with many artists, painters, sculptors, you name it, printmakers. A lot of great print portfolios were done. And so I did a traveling exhibition of that, of his collaborations with artists. And so that was the last project I did at the Castellani, pretty much, and then I moved on to my current position at Buffalo Spree as editor.
And how long have you been at Buffalo Spree?
Since 99, so I guess it will be almost 18 years,
almost 18
and,
years.
In August.
Wow. And so it's so interesting hearing about how accessible, I don't want to presume, but the relationship between writers and print writing has changed dramatically in the past 15 years, you know, and to hear that you were getting these opportunities to write for some really amazing paper or magazines and publications.
Well, it didn't really pay that well.
Yeah, really, yeah.
But and also, the kind of writing that you had to do for, say, Art News, it was a bit formulaic. Mm-hmm. The reviews could only be so long. Art in America in particular wanted you to be very descriptive, and you didn't really get to express yourself. I think Art Forum was a little better.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little dry, you know, and actually I've had more fun writing columns for, at that time back in the 90s, Art Voice, which I just had this sort of column called Writing on the Wall, and I could just do anything. No one really cared. So that was fun. And plus it, people that I knew read it. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't know anyone who read art magazines. I still know very few people who read art magazines.
It's true. I read them on my phone, but I don't get the actual publication, so it doesn't help them much. Can you talk a little bit about your trajectory at Spree and some of the things that you've done there and sort of the directions you've pulled that organization into?
Well, I think that Spree always had, even though it wasn't what I thought of as a city regional magazine along the lines of, say, New York Magazine. When I was at the Spectrum in the early 80s, we looked at Spree and thought it was very odd and didn't understand why it wasn't like New York Magazine, that it didn't sort of report more on the doings of Buffalo instead of the format that it had. There was poetry, and I'm not really quite sure what the mission was.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was to make Spree a city regional magazine. And that was the goal of the publishers, and I agreed with that goal. I thought it was a great idea to make it more responsive to what was actually going on in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Try to, you know, get the audience maybe, you know, a wider, more diverse audience, a younger audience, which we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of art, I will say this, throughout its 50-year history, Spree has always liked to cover art. Like it was in the 60s, it covered one of the big Festival of the Arts that was held here in Buffalo, you know, when Merce Cunningham and John Cage, and so that they saw that happening, realized that that was something that ought to be covered. I wonder if maybe, like other, in those days, how much coverage other local media would have given it if they even kind of understood, because it was pretty avant-garde stuff.
And was that June in Buffalo?
That was not June in Buffalo. Okay. This is Festival of the Arts.
Okay.
I think it was called that, or Buffalo Festival of the Arts, and it was really sort of an international affair.
We have actually a researcher here right now who's...
I think June in Buffalo may have grown out of that, maybe.
Okay.
That could be.
Because I think that was new music focused as
It was
well.
Dance, it was visual art, mm-hmm. very conceptual visual art.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time, and I'm sure you've heard this, and this is in the book, The Wayward Muse mm-hmm. documents it. I think that Life magazine called Buffalo the Acropolis of the avant-garde because at that time in the 60s there was other things happening in terms of forward progressive literature and the whole scene then. So Spree covered that. So really that was something that was really already in Spree's wheelhouse and it was something that I continued. And it was just since I already kind of knew everyone, particularly in the, you know, museum and gallery field, but also really easy to sort of bring in theater and classical music and, you know, popular music, dance, whatever. And so we've always had a big arts section. It's really fun. And I've been able to do a lot of that writing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And yes, Spree very much is what I turn to when I want to see a broad array of what's going on in the arts in Buffalo because, you know, well, Art Voice really isn't doing that as successfully anymore. The public is trying to figure out, you know, other different
I think the Buffalo News
well.
Does a pretty good job, too.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems so. I mean, it's hard for me to tell because I read it digitally. You have a whole different perspective when you're reading things online. But I do see the coverage,
mm-hmm.
particularly with public art.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely coverage. The public, you know, they've really committed by using their cover and they're having their centerfold often focused on that.
Yeah.
Art Voice obviously has changed a lot since I wrote for it.
Right. No, that's wonderful. That's awesome.
Did you want to ask more about the Castellani? Because we did kind of skim past that.
I do want to ask more about the Castellani. So you were at the Castellani in the 90s.
Right, from 91 through like 99.
Yeah. And how did that organization grow and change?
Well, I think they have still the same amount of staff members they had when I was there, but so I don't know about growing. But I found it a very stimulating place to work. I worked with Sandy Olson, who was the director. She really allowed us to sort of realize the projects that we really cared about,
mm-hmm.
as long as we could bring them in on budget and write the grants. We had to do our own grants. There was no outside grant writers, and that was actually fine. I had no problem with it. We wrote our own press releases. We did all had to do all that ourselves because we had a small staff, but that never really bothered me. And plus it was writing. So I had a lot of fun. I brought in artists coming over from doing residencies from overseas. There was an international residency with a Spanish artist who had this wild project, and he needed all kinds of crazy things, like a big fish. And then we had to have made a suit, a camouflage suit for the fish that had zippers and everything. And fortunately, our education curator was also a seamstress, so she was able to pull that together. And then it was put into this, you know, then there was a camouflage room. And there's other things I couldn't help him with. He wanted to take pictures from the top of the NOCO towers by the Grand Island Bridge, and I couldn't get a hold of those people for him. But it worked out really well. And what he ended up doing ended up being photography, so I went and had all this stuff photographed. And I thought that was fun. The MFA shows were a riot because we were the only museum, I guess, not that there's that many, that did MFA shows. And one of them was really interesting. Joe Bergel, he made this sort of Rube Goldberg contraption. It had lines of gunpowder and then things that had water. And you know what I mean by Rube Goldberg, like you set something in motion and then it just goes along, just like dominoes, mm-hmm. Okay, a domino effect. Makes other things happen, and it sort of travels this whole circuit. So he lit the, and we had to have all the alarms shut off, but he lit the gunpowder, and a lot of it we couldn't even see because like the room filled with smoke, but that was really fun. Burke Patterson, his toaster installation, I have one, and I really met a lot of artists, and I also was curating down at Olean. Mm. I did some collaborations with Hallwalls. Sarah Kellner and I did a collaboration of art about food called Consuming Passions, and we had some wonderful installations that were both at Hallwalls and at the Castellani for that show. I did a project, again, with writing with Jean-Michel Basquiat's drawings and a poet, Kevin Young, who I think is now director of the Schomburg Museum in New York. Anyways, Kevin wrote poems based on the drawings. This actually was sort of a traveling show because it came up from a small gallery in Florida, which was being run by another Buffalonian, Amy Capolazzo, who you may have heard of now, is a big auction house person. So that was fun bringing Kevin in, and we had a poetry slam with the NU students. So there's always an education element to the projects that we did. There was a lot of Tim Rollins and KOS came and did a residency, and they did a special painting for the Castellani, which Armin bought for the collection. And they came and talked to some of the surrounding high school students, because that's all about education and help project. So there were just a lot of fun things.
Oh, that sounds so great. Yeah. And so one thing that I try to tease out when I think about the Castellani is, so it is part of Niagara University,
yes.
But it used to be a private collection of the Castellani.
It was always part of Niagara University, okay? But the collection itself, that's where the disconnect is slightly, because at first belonged solely to Armin Castellani, but he gradually donated a lot of that to the museum, and we had a small purchase fund with which we could make purchases. I remember I went to one of the first SEPA auctions and got one of those little Cindy Shermans for the collection, and that was really exciting. It was only like $1,200 too. That was back in 94.
Yeah.
So he has eventually, he or his children have now donated a lot of that work either to the Castellani, and some of it went to the Albright Knox.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now it's a little more, now it's almost everything belongs to Niagara University, more or less. I'm sure there's still a few things. And there were other important donors then. There was the Milrad, there was a few people, I've forgotten a lot of this, but there was a lot of different names of collectors who had stuff in the museum, which would eventually be donated, and I think most of it has, but I don't want to speak for them and shouldn't.
Totally. Can you speak, as somebody who has been active in the as somebody who's been involved in curation in Buffalo for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
can you speak a little bit of like what was different back then, both with the awareness of practices and techniques, but also maybe the response of the community?
The thing about the Castellani was it was difficult to get people there, and I think that's still true.
Yeah.
I enjoyed my projects, but we always took a long time to plan. I like to plan things.
Mm-hmm.
And to work with the artists over a period of time. And I think the thing that's weird about it, you work with these artists or this artist, and you get really so you have relationships with them. And then they leave and they're gone. But I guess that's different here because you have artists who are part of the community. And sometimes we worked with local artists as well. Mm-hmm. But I always loved working with artists. And I did some guest curating projects for various places. Carnegie Art Center, quite a number of projects. And also with UB's Anderson Gallery, I did a project with them.
And excuse me for not remembering this, but were you involved with the Wayward Muse in a...
No, that's a little before my time.
Okay, was that? Okay, I know Albie was really involved with that.
Yeah.
That was such a good... That publication has become...
It's very useful.
It's so useful.
Yeah. Yeah, that came out... I was probably writing at that time, but I certainly was not doing any kind of curating or anything like that. Wasn't it late 80s?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yep. I think they are working on doing a second version of it.
Yeah, that would be needed.
Yeah. What are, as a curator, as somebody who has done that role for a number of different years, what are some traits that you look for in an artist that you work with that helps you understand, that helps you get to a successful outcome with them?
I like it if they can talk about their work in a way that I can understand, because I'm going to have to be writing about that work, and it will help me try to figure out how to install that work. Mm-hmm. I think it's important that the artist understand the space that they're working in and not just automatically think, I want to show everything that I've made in this space. And I think the curator's job is to be a curator and say, well, actually, it'd be better if we only showed 10 paintings. And if that's really what would be best, that's going to be best for the artist and the space and the show and the audience. And I think... Otherwise, I just look for them to be interesting and have interesting ideas or great work or whatever.
That's always helpful.
Yeah.
Work that is worth exhibiting makes a huge difference. Do you find that any of the skills you developed as a curator have translated into your role at Spree?
Oh, absolutely, because I'm still working with artists. You know, I'm working with the designers who are all, many of whom went to art school. Or they went to graphic design or whatever they did. So I enjoy that, and I understand their need for good images, and I try to get those images for them. I don't, you know, give them a piece of text and expect them to somehow make that look great. You really have to sort of help. You have to understand that it needs to be visual. It needs to look good, you know, regardless of how good the writing is. You know, you need more than that.
Yep, totally. In your role at Spree, you have worked or come into contact with many local artists over the years, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How do you find your role at Spree has affected your relationship with the more the Buffalo Metro community of artists?
Well, I think a lot of them know who I am, and some of them understand how far ahead we work. So, like certain artists like Kyle Butler, when he has shows coming up, he always knows when to email me and let me know about the show. And, you know, because he wants to get something into our print magazine. And to do that, you've got to really contact me like 2.5-3 months in advance of whatever it is that you're doing. And other than that, I still remain in contact with artists as a board member of Hallmalls, and it's, you know, so I'm involved with its programming somewhat, as you know, and I still have this sort of outsider relationship with artists because I'm not an artist, I'm a writer, and so I'm writing about their work, and they always thank me, but I don't really know what they really think about it.
Right, because you're kind of on the outside.
Exactly.
And they don't know,
to
be honest with you, or where that line is.
Right.
But one thing I really like about you and is that you always show up. You know, like, you're one of the people that is seen at openings and at exhibits and at events and stuff like that. And I think that all those nonverbals of just your presence, I think, shows a lot of your focus on this region's work, you know, just outside of your job, you know, but also how that's all tied
together. Thanks for saying that. I don't get to as much stuff as I'd like to.
Then you've done well enough that it's like, it's just like the ghost, you know.
I actually don't get here as much as I want to.
Yeah. And you know, and you do also get a slight benefit, because I'm thinking now, there's been a few times where I've seen Alan but not you, but in my head I'm like, oh, well, if Alan's there, then Elizabeth's there.
He's very good.
Yeah.
But we both, I mean, that's our form of entertainment. That's our, we consider that part of our world. That's the world that we like to be in. So, yeah.
I'd like to ask you some questions about Buffalo over the past 20 years. You know, we are in this uptick, according to some, this resurgence, but also this resurgence that's not affecting all of Buffalo equally,
no, of course not.
And in some ways is making it more difficult for those of us who have been here for a while. But what are some of the changes you've been noticing in the past few years, especially within the Buffalo arts community?
Well, okay, one thing, I don't know if this is what you're aiming at, but I have noticed that artists are really putting things together for themselves.
Cool. This is cool. Yeah.
Like the original spirit of Hallwalls back in the 70s is being recreated in artists who are just like finding a space, doing a pop-up show, not waiting, you know, and we've seen this, you know, for the past at least, you know, 5-10 years. We've seen this artist just like, I want to have this show, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to do it in this space. I'm not waiting for a curator to choose me. And other than that, though, I guess I think the Western New York curators are as good as they've ever been in terms of really getting out there and finding interesting artists. I mean, in terms of artists finding sort of commercial success, I don't really know if there's any more of that, but you never have that anyways, and artists are never commercially successful, or hardly ever. So.
And I have to say, Hallwalls is doing so much right now to carry on that torch of the importance of celebrating young and emerging artists, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
the
Amid in Western New York,
sure, yeah,
has just been, you know, many of us say that we're so incredibly like proud of what Hallwalls is doing, and it's kind of helping the Birchfield realize, like, man, we should have been, you know, more involved.
Well, and bringing in Kyle and, you know, and Rebecca to help with that, two younger artists. You know, I think is a really big, important part of that project with John Massier.
Yeah. And one thing I love that maybe I think is true at Spree as well as here is that so many of our arts organizations are staffed by artists, you know, and I think that really influences the cyclical quality of it. You know, Ron Emke, just, you know, writing for Spree, but at the same time has this rich life as a performative artist and all these different aspects over the years, but you know, you don't shut off that side of yourself when you come to work.
No, you don't. And our artists at Spree all have their little side projects, you know, that they do, that in which they, you know, kind of they do books. You know, like one of our artists had done a book for kids. Another artist, he designs all of the stuff for Toy Theater of Youth and enjoys fooling around with video. Mm-hmm. And so they're all really active. You know, and so that's really nice. Yeah.
What are some of the things, as the editor-in-chief of Spree, what are some of the things you look for when you, how do I want to say this? What makes you excited about an emerging artist on the scene that makes you want to cover it? Or do you really rely on those artists to reach out to you and or reach out to Spree and try to draw Spree's attention? Is it, are you finding them or are they finding Spree?
Kind of a combo, I suppose. But I really do rely on people like Anna Kaplan and Elizabeth Samuels and Emily Tucker and Nina Freudenheim and Scott and people at SIPA, Larry at SIPA and people at UB and at the Castellani to let me know, because we only have 12 issues. So what I say to them is like, what's your big project? What would you like us to really focus on? What would you like us to really do something big with?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And but then I'm always, if somebody just gets me a press release and a couple images, they're in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put them in.
Mm-hmm. Again.
If it's in time. Yeah.
I think that from what one thing from that I've encountered from interviewing a lot of artists, especially younger artists, is, you know, I guess I've heard a lot, they're like, you know, in art school, they teach you how to paint or they teach you how to make the thing, but they don't teach you how to market your art. And they don't teach you sometimes how to even put together a portfolio. You know, it's all about the brushstroke, but not about how you're going to live your life.
Right. I think there's a class like that at UB, or was. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how up to date it is. Mm-hmm. I think Ron's taught it in the past. But yes, it's absolutely true. But if they're working with, and that's why it's good to work with curators, because curators do know all that stuff and can help them market themselves. And I think, too, look at what AJ and Karen are doing with the Collect Art, where they don't even have to store any artwork or anything like that. They've taken a lot of the pain out of it, but they're still selling art. They're still getting their friends' artwork out there and sold.
It's an incredible model that they've established. Yeah. And it's so cool because AJ was actually the first Living Legacy Project artist I ever interviewed, because he was I was like, okay, we'll have a real good talk. And at that time, it was before he met Karen, he was suffering through he was already doing very well in mm-hmm. Buffalo, but even he was suffering with how to promote himself and how to find the energy to promote oneself. Because oftentimes, what I'm finding too is that with many artists, the skill set to really be in touch with your creative self enough to create something mm-hmm. stunning or powerful is not always the same skill set as being able to go out there and market yourself.
Right, but it's not that hard. Yeah. It's just an email. All it takes is an email. Hi, you don't know me. I have a show. I mean, I really ask that they have a show. If I get an email from an artist saying that I'd like you to look at my art and maybe write about it, I'm like, when can people see it? Mm-hmm. And maybe I shouldn't be that way, but it's the one kind of way that I can narrow it down and decide on things to focus on, and also because I want to get our readers out to look at work and not just tell them about work that they may or may not mm-hmm. be able to see.
Mm-hmm. This is incredibly helpful. This is awesome. This is a lot of really good information that I'm really grateful you're sharing, because I think a lot of local artists will... It's not that they're not capable, I just don't know if they've been thinking this way, especially younger people, who are maybe just having their first or second show out there and have, this is all very new.
Right, and there aren't these deep staffs at any institution, I don't care what it is, that can really, except maybe the Albright Knox, that can really promote, that have the time to get the word out, maybe that they should. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing wrong with the artist, just sending an email with a couple images. I have this show coming up. It's I'm very excited about it. Here's why. They don't have to write a press release even or anything, as long as they can just express in a few words why they think it's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Which makes me realize next year, though you are probably so sick of infringement, next year I will...
I'm not sick of infringement. In fact, it's so funny because we were just trying to figure out who the contact person for infringement was, and it's so relentlessly, is it?
This year, and it's been...
There's a whole list of names. We're not hierarchical. Well, that's all very well.
I know.
But we need to have one contact.
Yeah. Right. You talked to... Well, and last year I was like really in that role. This year I don't have the spoons, and so I'm trying to spread it out amongst different people, but it's still kind of coming back to me. But there are things that... I haven't been too on top of them because, with infringement, it's whatever everyone has to give, and I acknowledge what I haven't been great at giving. But I'm your contact person, and if it's not too late, I would love to send you a brief blurb of what's going on this year. But it's okay if it is, too.
We have a bunch of infringement stuff going into the... You know what I need? I need images.
Yes.
The words are done, because Donna... Hope did a thing on it.
Yes, and we're really excited.
So that's why it's so easy to do that kind of stuff, because I have people like her, people like Ron, Phil Nyheis. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to worry about being able to cover things because I have people who love to cover it. Mm-hmm. So that's good. And Chris Schobert for film, all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I desperately need images.
Okay, it'll be past year's images, but
I don't care.
We've got really
of
great
course,
ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking for mine because I remember always taking pictures. I can't find any of them.
That was wonderful.
So what are you doing next year for infringement, you said?
This year? I was just saying it's not 2 months out right now.
Okay,
so I was
I
was acknowledging that I missed that window myself.
Yeah, fortunately you have Donna Hoke.
Yes. Yep.
So she knows the calendar.
Yeah.
And she will just go and get
the
information.
We're so excited that she's involved this year.
Yeah.
And it's really, really, really impressive. I'm like, we're kind of all like, oh my gosh, Donna Hoke wants to be involved this
year. I did her car stories last year.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. It's going to be, I think we have 360 performers or groups or something at 400 venues over the 11 days.
Oh my God.
And most performers do more than one show. It's the 13th year that this has happened, but it's that infringement's such an unwieldy beast. You know, most of the time I feel like it's going to keep going even if we don't program anything. You know, people just go out and play in the streets because they are used
right.
to it at this point.
Right.
But an interesting thing, too, about Spree, because I do see Spree as a really important way that people get information about what's going on in Buffalo in a way that extends across the Buffalo metro line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there's a lot of support for Spree out in the suburbs as
mm-hmm.
well, in a way that the public maybe doesn't have traction out there the same way in certain places and stuff like that. And so I do see Spree as like this opportunity to link the suburbs and the city. And do you ever feel that approach in sort of how you...
We've always thought about ourselves as Western New York.
Yeah.
And when I first came to work at Spree, of course, the offices were in Williamsville on Main Street. They had never been in the city. People was like, why did you move out? Well, we were never in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So then we moved to Sheridan Drive. And then we went to Corporate Parkway off Maple,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of near UB.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really exciting to move into a space that was being designed just for us. You know, that was incredible. But I never felt apologetic for being out in the suburbs or having our office there, because those are our readers and subscribers as well, of
mm-hmm.
course. And I did not mind driving out there. It was not that big of a deal. So,
but the new building or the new location out
yeah.
at the Foundry is
yeah.
gorgeous.
Yeah, we love it. Yeah,
yeah.
We love it there.
And it feels like the kind of perfect spot for you to be, you know, sort of almost like in between all of it.
It was amazing how many choices we had. The first time we looked, before we moved to off Maple, 100 Corporate Parkway, there were a couple places that were not Class A office space, and we couldn't get on board with them.
Mm-hmm.
But this last move, there was 701 Seneca, you know, there was a place right on Delaware Avenue, like almost across from Hall Walls. There was really a lot more choice.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it was great.
Can we talk about Hall Walls a little
sure,
bit?
Sure, yeah.
So how long have you been involved with Hall Walls in any capacity?
Oh, well, as a writer, since the 80s. You know, like I said, I used to, they had the Macrozoom project. It was like Super 8 Film Festival there, and I wrote about that because my boyfriend at that time was into filmmaking and was studying with John Hand and Tony Conrad and Paul Sheritz and all those guys. And then, so I just continued covering it, and often in the 80s and early 90s, when Richard Huntington was the art critic, he would put me on like the video program, sort of the independent film program, and just stuff that he was less interested in. Performance, you know, and that was tough because that one night stuff, you had to go back to the news and write it that night. That was when the writers could still go to the news. I think that's all done remotely now. So I was in and out of Hall Walls all the time. I'm just regular there. We go to all their openings, all their stuff. Then I somehow got involved in doing the anniversary project. When I was at the Castellani, I worked on that with Sarah Kellner, and we co-curated Hall Walls' 20th anniversary show.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped Ron sort of co-edited, or at least worked with him, producing the Consider the Alternatives, the book about that. So I worked on that as well, interviewed people for that, and it was really fun. Got to interview, I remember interviewing Michael Zwack, who just passed away, and of course Charlie. Tony Bannon had already done a lot of the other interviews for a project that never came to fruition for 10 years, I think. It didn't happen. And I'm not sure why, but but we had all those interviews.
You had them.
Yeah, we had them. So, I'm not quite sure how that went down. So there was all that, and I helped Ron put it all together in the themes that maybe you've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And well, the whole thing's online now, so that's cool. So I don't even know how I got involved with that, except that just being known as a writer and a curator, and having co-curated other projects with Sarah. There was a shows at Hallwalls, in addition, artists I introduced her to. So we sort of had somewhat of a relationship where we would work together on stuff. So it was, she was very open to having other people come in and do things.
I think that's so important. I think it's so important to keep things dynamic and interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're only going to have a limited lens, you know, and there's so many out there. What was Hallwalls like back in the 80s?
Well, I don't know too much about the early 80s. The later 80s I sort of knew. And back then, as I recall, there was sort of a financial crisis that came about. Sort of a perfect storm, maybe, of some mismanagement, some loss of funding, and I think that was when Ed Cardonis had stepped in and became director, and
Don came here.
Right, that's right, and had to sort of pull Hallwalls out of that swamp. And you know, any organization like Hallwalls, you name it, they go through these kinds of, unfortunately, they go through these kinds of financial crises. As a board member for Hallwalls, we've already seen a period where we were, you know, having difficulty, you know, meeting payrolls and so on. But then grants come along, you have successful fundraisers, and you just have to sort of fundraise and yourself out of it. And that's how you do it.
We're dealing with that. I'm on the board now at Locust Street.
Yeah, some issues there. Yeah, I've heard.
Oh yeah. It's actually really heartening to know that it's actually within a long tradition, you know, of arts organizations dealing with loss of funds and mismanagement and all these different parts. And it was cool. There was a volunteer group that was trying to strategize to see what they could do. And Tony Bellani was there. And it was actually great to have him there because he was like, you know, you're not the first who's been here. Hallwalls was there. Everyone's been there.
Everyone.
Everyone's
yeah.
been there. You're going to find a way through. And I think we really needed to hear that at that moment. Mm-hmm. And having Dorothy at the helm is everything. Because she's the interim ED for right now.
Oh, okay.
Because she, if anyone can save this place. Yeah. And so, you know, seeing that history in Buffalo and seeing like kind of the stumbling blocks that are hit over and over again by different organizations.
Yeah, SEPA, Squeaky Wheel.
Yeah.
I mean, there really isn't an organization that hasn't had its issues.
Yeah.
You know, you're fortunate to be at a place that has this museum. I mean, that has this university there or college to support it. And it just has, you know, the Castellani. But that comes with its own problems, too, because you're part of this great big organization that sometimes doesn't really think that what you do is, because every department in any given college or university thinks that it, you know, unbeknownst to others, is the most important department. And without it, you know, the university or college would be nothing. So,
yep,
so you have to deal with that.
You're totally right. And we are actually really lucky here at the Birchfield because we have our own 401c3.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It is kind of like this, like,
yeah.
when we go to the museum conferences and everything, all the other college museums don't even know what to do with us, you know, because we have a degree of freedom and autonomy that is practically unheard of, which is super cool. But then again, yeah, a lot of Buff State doesn't get what we do. But this is great. We've kind of been just hitting some of these pretty organically. But I'd like to ask a little bit about you and some of your interests in the arts. What are some things that you love writing about within a arts context? You know, what type of art excites you? Do you allow yourself to get excited, or do you try to be more objective?
No, I always get excited. And really, there's no one type of art. I really love a very wide variety of things. I guess I'd like there to be some visual excitement. But then I kind of like the challenge of writing about something, like, say, something real conceptual, like the show that it was at the Albright Knox, and they all they had done is really pulled away the drywall to show the boards underneath, and that was the artwork. And that's really fun to write about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's fun. So I like installations that sort of take over a change of space. That's really fun. I really don't have I don't have a genre.
I'd like to ask you about some of the artists in Buffalo that you've known over the years as well. Like you mentioned Tony Conrad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tony, actually, when I interviewed him, he's the one who got inspired me to get this device we have now because he brought one of these to record
mm-hmm.
me as I was recording him. But can you speak a little bit about Tony Conrad and who you knew him to be? I don't know. Were you guys not? I don't know if I sometimes
yeah,
never know.
Yeah, I was
know.
On fine with. I was
yeah.
fine with him.
Yeah,
we always got along. I've spent time at his house. He one of my boyfriends was sort of his roommate. He had a place over on, I think it was over on West. It was not a great part of the Lower West Side. And he was just hilarious. We would sit around and make fun of form letters that came from, like, AT&T about fiber optic cable. You know, and we would read these aloud and find something, like, hilarious about them. I'm not quite sure why. But he was just a great talker, and I've interviewed him. I interviewed him for, I think the main thing I interviewed him was for the Squeaky Wheel. Yes, it was the Squeaky Wheel anniversary thing. I like doing these anniversary projects, like the Big Orbit anniversary project and book. I worked on that as well. And I like doing timelines. I like doing histories
mm-hmm.
and sort of researching the history of a, you know, of an organization and looking through all the archives. I like doing all that. So that's definitely something. It's not it's really an art form. But yeah, so Tony is someone that I knew. Paul Sheritz is someone that I knew. He was a little more difficult
Can
to hang out with.
Can you speak about him a little bit?
Well, we lived on Lafayette, and he did too. And we would go over to his house and watch films. My sister was a friend of his. He was fun to hang out with, but he would, well, you know, he was a drinker and would have, and had, you know, was sort of a little unstable. I guess Tony was too, but he would get sort of angry sometimes, Paul would.
Mm-hmm.
Or you would go over and, like, the whole house would be open and he would just be there sleeping, you know, passed out. And, like, I remember bringing artists to visit him. Like, oh, my God, Paul Sheritz. And I'm like, oh, I guess we can't really see Paul right now, you know. But he was interesting guy. I mean, what can you say about these people? They were, you know, they were fun to be with.
Mm-hmm. That is the sense I get from the people from, yeah, like Paul Sheritz. And I was lucky to know Tony just a little bit and, you know, got to interview him. But at this point, especially with, like, Paul Sheritz, to me and to many people here who may research him in the archives, he's a concept at this point. You know, he was not, I know that he was volatile.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he was brilliant. I know that he was very difficult to work with. But trying to get to humanize these people is something that when I have the opportunity, I like to try and touch on. Which is why, so Fred Bakker, is he okay to talk about?
Sure, yeah.
Could
mm-hmm.
you describe who he
well,
was
he
a
was,
little bit?
Well, he was someone I first sort of learned about in the early 80s. I was living over on Jersey then, and I would go to... He started showing, I think, in the video program. I think the first thing I might have seen is something called... Oh, no. The first thing I saw was a film. It was called Gloam, and it was shown Central Park Grill, probably. And I think that Cardone also had a little film in there. And I don't know exactly who curated it, whether it was a Hallwalls project or not.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred was trying to get his... At that time, you had to get the MAH combining what was then Center for Media Studies with another department. Often people went to the English department. You couldn't get an MFA from CMS. Maybe you can now from DMS. I don't know. So anyway, but you could. So you had to sort of combine. You had to drag in another discipline to, you know, get your master's, which Fred was after. And he was having some problems with that. But that's what he was working on. And so he showed this film, Gloam. And it was just him walking around. I think he had a cape on or something. And he would just be saying, Gloam, Gloam, Gloam. And there might have been some other dialogue. I remember My Life in Muzak, that was a video. I think he recited something in the Cold Canadian Nights. That's what I mainly remember about that. And he would have music. He liked the music from Taxi Driver. He would use that sometimes. And he just had a very expressive face. And it was really very much an actor and could assume various persona. And of course, the one video he had called I'm a Nightclub, and I was actually with him, living with him sometimes during the entire making of that, which involved other Buffalo people who aren't here anymore, like Brian Springer was in that, Joni LaFond, who is still here, was in that, Armin Hurick was involved in that, and a few other people. My sister was briefly in that. And there are only a few snippets of that still exist. And he just was a brilliant guy. He was a very funny writer and just would, like, sort of totally undisciplined in every way, would spend most of the day sort of smoking and hanging out, reading the paper in coffee shops, and then moving on to bars. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much it. And somehow in between there, he would get some writing done for his projects and spend a lot of time in editing, you know, editing them. So he was a hard worker, but sort of in a, if you can be a hard worker in an extremely undisciplined way, which I believe you can be. Yeah. So.
Sounded very bohemian.
Yeah, yeah. So, but very smart, and he could have channeled his talents in any one of, like as an essayist or, I mean, a humorist maybe. He even did cartoons and things. So there's lots of things he could have done if he'd maybe been just a little more conservative, but I don't think that was in his nature to be.
I saw the one video for, and I did go to the memorial that was in honor of him a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, it's always really interesting to be so excited by someone who you never met, you know, in this way where you're surrounded by people who did know him deeply, you know. But I love the video for Ronald Reagan Goes to Hell.
Oh, yes. That's part of I Am a Nightclub.
Okay. That's part of that?
Yes. That's one of the characters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about where his documentation is? Like, where?
I gave him that Casio that he uses.
You gave him that? Okay.
It's my sister's. Maybe she gave, I think she gave it to him, or sold it to him, probably.
But so, like, any of this documentation, I mean, it's...
Well, he... A lot of his stuff was done on, what, 3/4-inch videotapes. And then he never transferred any of it over the years, which he could have done, I think. So I think it... And where was it kept? I mean, I think Richard Wicca had a lot of it.
Okay.
And they might have had some at DMS.
Okay.
But I think from both those entities said that there really was nothing that could be rescued from those. I think those are the only things that remained. I think. So it's kind of unfortunate. Had they been transferred at least to DVD or something, we would still have them. And I believe there was a point where at least they could have been transferred maybe to 1/2-inch and then transferred to DVD or something.
Speaking of Richard Wicca, can you talk a little bit about Richard and Ron in the early 90s? Did you know them at that time, either individually or when?
I knew Ron. I was not in on their whole collaboration. I have to be honest with you, I was not really, although unfortunately Richard Wicca is the only kind of person who would actually sit down and watch something like this.
Can we talk about Ron?
Sure, okay.
And we're doing great for time. As long as you're okay, we'll be
done
maybe
fine.
15 minutes.
I'm fine.
Okay. It's a rare treat to get to interview someone like you who's been around all these awesome artists for so long and can kind of speak a little bit to their character. Because even character assessments, I think, also speaks to the community that we're all a part of here, you know, and I appreciate that. But talk about Ron in the early 90s.
Well, you know, Ron is this really great guy who is very open, and he's very kind, and he likes to do all different kinds of stuff. And he sort of drew Fred into this project called Death of a Mammal. But I was going to grad school in New York then. So I, during the middle of '80s, I was coming back and forth because I was trying to get a PhD at City University, New York, which I never got. I would come in and there'd be like these projects that would be going on, you know, and Ron was sort of at the heart of this. And Ron, of course, is someone that my husband, Alan, knew from grad school at UB. And so we were all kind of friends with him. But I didn't really become closer to Ron, I suppose, during the time that we worked on the Howells thing, So we would be working together on stuff. But that was kind of tense because we were just trying to get this book done.
Yeah.
It's a big book. There's a lot in it. It was hard to get done. But he was very funny, you know, because we would be sending faxes, I don't know why, from Castellani to Hallwalls, and there would be a place on the fax for a title, and Ron would write, you know, Lord Most High, or, you know, stuff like that. And he just, you know, I sort of envied the kind of camaraderie, and also I work with Ron because I was always very open to writing about his projects, Ways in Being Gay. It's like, that was my gig. I wrote about Ways in Being Gay for Art Voice. No one else wanted to write about Ways in Being Gay. It was me. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and maybe for the news as well. So I would talk to him, so that gave me an opportunity that was great. Because anytime you write about something at Hallwalls, you always want to talk to the curator and find out, you know, this is not some straightforward thing. This isn't like walking into an exhibition here. I don't really feel like I need to talk to the curators when I come to the Birchfield. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I see what this is. Mm-hmm. But with the Hallwalls projects, that's not really the case. There's always sort of a story about why they're doing what they're doing and why they've chosen this or that and so on. And we really had fun interviewing different people for the Hallwalls book, and especially people who were hostile to Hallwalls, like Charles Wright, who's a former curator, really hated Hallwalls and hated everyone at Hallwalls and was very frank about this during our interview. And there were other people who were angry about certain things and you know, didn't, you know, there's all this crazy stuff going on. You know, it's just, it's a really small community. But I sort of really knew Ron better when he started writing more for Spree and then actually came in and started working at Spree, and he got into gardening, and then we started bonding over that. In fact, I'm supposed to go over and check out what he's up to at his garden now. Has he been in? Okay. I just think that Ron is a great writer, and he's just a very entertaining, kind of hilarious person. And so I just feel I wish I could get him to write more for Spree than, you know, just doing concert reports. It's like a glorified calendar. And so I just, because when he, well, what I would do with Ron is I would send Ron to do things that, you know, Ron wouldn't ordinarily have done, like go to a spa and get a facial, stuff like that. Or we feng shuied his cubicle. That was funny. And there was a fish. The feng shui person put in, like, that would help him to have a living thing. So it was like this, it was one of those betta fish, you know, and it had plants, you know, strands of leaves coming out of it, and it was this glass pitcher filled with water, which actually gave me the inspiration to use fish for Ron's centerpiece at his wedding. Well, plus their nautical theme, mm-hmm. which was really cool.
I remember those centerpieces.
Yes.
They were amazing centerpieces.
Yeah. Thank
That's
you.
That's why
yeah,
I freaked
yeah,
out a little. Yeah.
So... he had the fish, they changed everything around, and we had before and after pictures, but eventually the fish did die. And so then one of the artists, Josh, did a whole memorial to the fish, and JP did a beautiful drawing of the fish, like sort of a watercolor drawing. I don't know how much time they spent on this. And he did like a fake memorial website for the fish and printed it out, and then there was people wrote their comments about her and how important she was to their lives, and so on. And why did it have to be Ruby? Why couldn't it have been Ron instead?
So that's what I love about Ron. Like, he takes things
He would inspire
so
this
far.
Kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And he'll take it so far that, like, what seems like just a gag joke all of a sudden becomes this huge performative
project.
Thing.
Anything can be a project. I mean, that's what you learn from Ron.
Yeah.
It's anything. We've often speculated and just, like, we both have boxes of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm really good at getting rid of things, but I do have boxes of stuff from my art projects and things that, you know, I'm like, what if I just took all this out, all these, like, emails, and just we could do something with this, but, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. probably not a good idea.
I love that piece Yosef Bayous made years ago for the Beyond In, I think it was, that was a giant arc of all of his junk mail for a year.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Do you remember that piece?
Mm-hmm.
Man, yeah, that's like, I could see myself.
Yeah, I like correspondence work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely like that. Yeah. I like that kind of work. That's fun.
Speaking of all these artists that you know and are close with, What's it like being married to an artist like Alan Bigelow?
Well, he was a fiction writer when I first knew him.
Really?
Yeah, he was working on a novel, uh-huh. Pamela Small, and had just finished a series of short stories. And he'd had a short story in one of the Blatant Artifice series, and that was when Ed was running the fiction program at Hallwalls. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we met at Hallwalls, mm-hmm. so in an opening. It was the 1987 opening, the one that Robert Longo pulled together. I didn't meet him or anything. So he was just working on print fiction. And for a long time, well, he's already told you that story. But I was really impressed because he was not an intuitive computer person. He never studied it or took any kind of course that would show him how to do, or even a squeaky wheel course on how to use Flash or anything. He taught himself all this stuff to make, because he really felt, and this came out of, as I'm sure he told you, his interest in domain names. Because he thought he could maybe make some money, like buying a bunch of domain, but unfortunately all that money had been made uh-huh. by other people. So, but he had the domain names, like, what if I use this and made a website? Because if people want to look at websites and stuff on the web, then I'll make up. My stuff was now going to be on the web. That's how I get it. And it's just really, but he's just up there. It's amazing to me, with struggling with all this code, that he really does not know that much about. He just knows, it figures out enough to make what he needs to have happen. And I agree with that. I've never been one of those that hates artists because they have a staff or they have, you know, assistants who do a lot of the work, like Andy Warhol, say, or lots of artists.
Chihuly or any of them.
Yeah, any Longo for that matter. And so Alan will ask, he'll have coders make some of his stuff. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it he does himself. So I have a lot of respect for that. And I think his stuff is great. I think it's really, you know, it's funny and engaging.
So accessible.
And accessible. Yes.
So accessible.
Very accessible. And so I think that, I think it's a, and he's loves it. He's full speed ahead. He's still finishing up. He has me look at everything he does. And I'm like two projects behind in the bank robber thing because I've been very busy at Spree mm-hmm. with having Larry and then wife's in there now, and it's just really busy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's very busy.
But yeah, no, Alan's doing great work as well. And speaking specifically to like the accessibility part, like there's all sorts of times where I'll just like tell random people to like open up your phone, look at this website right now. Like you can just do whatever you want with this, and like have an experience wherever you are.
Some people don't understand it; they just don't get it.
Yep. Yep. And it takes time, and it depends on if you're wired that way a little bit.
Right,
and I think age.
But
is
I find that there's a lot of humor in it, so I don't understand why people wouldn't at least get that much out of it.
Yep.
And I think this stuff is I love the Flash piece. The Flash piece has had a certain sort of formal elegance that I think is harder to do with HTML.
Yep.
But what are you going to do?
Right.
But that's the beauty of it. You know, you can't work in, you know. You've got to change to HTML, so your concept better be good.
I'll tell you what, too. There is an ephemeral nature to what he does
mm-hmm.
that isn't immediately obvious. But yeah, you know, once Flash is totally
mm-hmm.
out of date, there's a whole body of work that he's
right.
going to have a very difficult time accessing again.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that I'm, you know, really proud of him for what he's accomplished with that. And I think it's, there's... he could have easily gone another way and just been bitter about never having his novel accepted. And I mean, that is such a difficult road to take, the whole, you know, successful fiction thing. And I do know some people who have done it, but I know other people just getting published and all that. And you're so many writers are now expected to help pay for their works to be published. And you don't really make any... I mean, it's not like it's not lucrative at all. You have to work as a teacher, which he's doing anyway. So, I think it's great. So
mm-hmm.
I hope he continues with it.
Mm-hmm. No, it is a really valuable body of work.
Yeah, I think
yeah.
so. I agree. I think it is.
I think the last question I have for you has to do with your role as an influencer and supporter of the arts, and also kind of tying in with your role at Hallwalls and what you've been seeing with the AMID in Western New York and stuff like that. What sort of insights do you have for emerging artists in Buffalo?
I think it's a really exciting place for them to be right now. I do. I think that they should get out there and make their projects happen. And maybe not always expect other people to make them happen for them. And I think that they should enjoy the Buffalo scene for what it is. I think it's a great art scene. I really do. Just the architecture and the surroundings of it, I think are inspiring and dynamic and inspirational. So I think this is always a good place to be an artist. I think it has been over the years.
Well, this is a cool question. Maybe, I don't know. As somebody who has been closely connected with artists in Western New York, what are some needs that artists have had here in Buffalo that you've experienced? Whether it be, I can give you a few that I know of off the bat, which is like the ability to exhibit. You know, like how does that, the ability to exhibit, the ability to be able to make sales, stuff like that. But, you know, having been friends with so many artists, what are some other things you've seen them go through in their careers? And this won't be our last question.
One of the things I see artists struggle with is that they make a body of work and they feel that they've gotten everything they can out of that particular body of work, that particular series, and they move on. And sometimes what they move on to is successful and sometimes it isn't. And it's really hard when you see people who really wish that you were doing what you were doing before. Or maybe an artist starts on one body of work and just continues with that to the point where they've gotten all they can out of it, but they might not realize it. And it just is not as fruitful as they thought it would be. So I think that's really hard for artists. I think it's hard to set prices and stick to them. A lot of artists struggle with the sort of donation culture that we have where they're asked to donate their work to so many different causes, even if they're good causes. I know artists struggle with that. So, and it's always hard, but then, you know, it's like, you know, when my boss Larry used to say, well, it's so hard to be a salesperson, you know, you have to understand, you know, this hurts their pocketbook if so and so. I'm like, well, they went into it. I didn't, you know, they're salespeople. That's what they went into. You know, I can't make, you know, it's like I can't control the amount of money I make like they can. I have different problems with my job. I have my own problems. Every job, every profession, you know, has its issues. So
that was a great answer. That was actually really helpful. That's very good. On our last question, maybe I'd like to leave it with, what do you love about Buffalo? What has kept you here?
Yeah, that is good. Because I have left. I was in New York for a while. But yeah, I have always liked it here. Even before whatever this resurgence and renaissance and all that is going on now happened, I just always liked it. I found it very comfortable. There was always just enough going on. It's comfortable, and when you, like when I was in New York, there'd be all kinds of things going on, but some of them I couldn't afford, and some of them were difficult, whatever the reason, there just wasn't the accessibility, which is a word that we've been using a lot. But I would come home to Buffalo for the weekend, and there'd be all these fun things going on, and I've always found it easier to make friends here for whatever purpose. At least when I was in New York in the 80s, everybody was really worried about success and impressing people, and you know, it just survival, you know. And I never found that here, so I just felt that it had just enough. It had everything that you needed. And now we see that it has so much more. I remember in the 80s, there was one Indian restaurant. It wasn't very good either. There just wasn't anything like what we have now, nothing. But we take it all for granted now. We were talking about the food trucks when I was on BFO earlier. He's like, I just see them all around and take them for granted. But it was not that long ago. There was like a huge battle and people were, you know, people were going to common council meetings and it was like a thing. Now it's like no one even cares. No one cares. So I remember when this was not here, and you just had the pokey little third fifth, but that was fine. We were excited about that. That's where we had the Halls anniversary show. So it adds, you know, new things. It does improve itself, Buffalo does. Now, of course, the sort of economic improvement that we've discussed not affecting the whole city, well, this is true of any city. We have poverty.
We have segregation.
Yeah, we have segregation. So we have those things. And I don't really know how those things get solved. Certainly, the kinds of development and sorts of initiatives that have taken place that we're aware of, like getting more Indian restaurants or changing a factory building into apartments, those aren't really going to do anything towards solving, nor should they. But that doesn't mean it's not good to have those things. It's just that when you look at solving those kinds of problems, you have to look somewhere else. You have to look at other strategies to solve those. In the meantime, I think there are small things that are making life in Buffalo better. I think the main thing I would look at is mass transportation. Just make our bus. I think our bus system is not nearly as bad as people say it is, but I think it could be made easier for people to use. And like, you know, having the subway go more places is also kind of a good idea. I think that would be a big boon. I think it would be helpful to people. Just make it easier for them to get around.
Thank you. That's actually really helpful. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Do you feel like there's anything that I've missed?
No. I feel we talked about lots of different things.
I do,
yeah,
too.
It was good.
Thank you so much for coming in to spend this time with
me
today.
Well, thanks for asking me. It was really nice.
Yeah.
It was really nice.
And check out this month and every month's Buffalo Spree magazine.